Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Nolan Higdon, in studio with my co-host, Desiree McSwain. This week on the show, we're going to talk about fake news and talk with some folks from the new startup Tribeworthy about how they plan to ameliorate the issues surrounding fake news. We'll also talk to Quentin Sankofa from Movement Generation, Justice and Ecology Project. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censor Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Nolan Higdon, in studio with Desiree McSwain and our senior correspondent, Michael Levitin. Today, we're going to be dealing with groups that are headed, led by, or fulfilled by millennials. So we're going to have a lot of young folks guests on the show. And I think it's a really perfect time for this. We saw how the baby boomers are no longer the largest majority of the voting populace. Millennials now are going to be the largest portion of the voting populace. So I think this is an exciting time to talk to some of these millennials and see the work they're doing. Before we do that, Desiree, we should probably get to headlines.
And these are brought to you by projectcensor.org. You can find them there as well as gcml.org. I'm going to start off with lawsuit alleges Monsanto intentionally mislabeled dangerous inert ingredients. This originally was brought to us by Intercept and student researcher Jessica Huey at Citrus College, as well as Andy Lee Roth at Citrus College. Monsanto misled the public into thinking its pesticides are safe and do not cause cancer when it knew that it does. Surprise. They argue that Monsanto did not conduct the necessary tests on the inert ingredients, Roundup, which contains POEA, which is very toxic. They didn't evaluate its dangers. Obviously, it was available to all of us, and it directly affected a lot of the workers, agricultural workers, which they told they would no longer be exposed to, and again, were. So this is a big topic right now, a lot of the GMO talk and all this kind of stuff going on, but specifically Roundup, I've been hearing a lot about.
Who did this study originally?
Intercept.
The Intercept, Glenn Greenwald's operation.
So is this story just on the impact on the workers who inhabit, or as well as those of us who ingest this food?
It definitely impacts both of us, but I think this one was specifically targeted at the workers because they had the direct contact with it.
The Intercept always does these like brilliant pieces that makes you think. We usually focus on like the ingestion of this food. I've not seen a lot of stories actually talk about the workers who have to put up with these things.
Yeah.
But the amazing thing is how many reports do we have to read as the American public about Monsanto, about products, about what is in the contents that they're feeding us and spraying. You know, we've been reading and hearing about these for years, and it's like, this is one more. I wonder when it pierces through and kind of has an impact, either on the legislative level or mobilizing people, because I sure am tired of hearing one more Monsanto behind-the-scenes story.
I think what's interesting, too, is that this almost aims at just the labeling aspect of it, so not so much the dangerous effects that it has on us physically, like you said, but just labeling and us as consumers in the consumerism age, what we want our stuff to say to make us feel better about what we believe is in it.
Yeah, I think that awareness is huge. I know there's like some studies, but I think increasingly less and less young people have had like a Big Mac. So young people are leading this way and kind of changing the food we eat and what we choose to eat. But labeling plays a huge role in that, right? Well, you have to have some sort of knowledge of the problems with these foods before you can make those informed decisions.
And it'll be interesting to see what happens to Vermont's law. I think Vermont was the first in the country just last year to try to establish labeling. But I think the industry fought back so hard that it is not assured that Vermont's going to be able to go through and really change the labeling. We'll see this year what they manage to do in the courts.
Next story, and this was brought to us by Women's E! News and student researcher Jane Howe and Andy Lee Roth over at Citrus College. Maternal mortality, a growing threat in the U.S. Each year, over 65,000 women in the U.S. suffer life-threatening complications aggravated by pregnancy. 600 die from pregnancy-related causes. Even deeper into it, African-American women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die from pregnancy-related causes. Georgia actually has the highest rate of maternal deaths and significant racial disparity. It also goes on to talk about addressing the problems and presenting solutions, which obviously is a big aspect to it because we really need solution-based ideas and a solution-based dialogue around this kind of thing. The U.S. is the only nation in the developed world with a rising maternal mortality rate.
Did they give any sort of reasons why? Do they think it's environmental or genetic, why African-American communities are hit harder by this?
They kind of dug into it a little bit. They said provider shortages, lack of physical access to care, low education attainment, poverty, poor access to healthy foods, neighborhood violence, and stress.
once more, America steps outside of the norm, right? I mean, no country in Europe. I think even Latin America and other places have this down a lot better than we do. It's pretty striking and just and quite depressing that America, with all of its technology and capabilities and wealth, is falling in that. In those numbers.
So you're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Nolan Higdon, in studio with Desiree McSwain, my co-host, as well as our senior correspondent, Michael Levitin. And we are currently going through headlines. These are validated independent news stories that Project Censored researchers find in the classroom and post online, stories the corporate media will not tell you. Desiree, what other headlines do you have for us?
This one's actually really interesting. Civil rights are blowing in the wind. Bob Dylan's songs highlight why Black Lives Matter. Lyrics: how many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas must a white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? Yes, and how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
So Desiree, who is the author of this piece, and how does the author connect this concept of the Black Lives Matter movement with Bob Dylan's music?
Jennifer Michaud at Worcester State University. She is the author. First, they also talked about the fact that he had another song, Bob Dylan, about Emmett Till and that situation in the South. And they really drawed a parallel to what's going on today and also how we use media and music specifically in this day and age.
Well, I think Bob Dylan always played a crucial role for the civil rights movement and Black liberation causes. And that song, how many years can some people exist before they're allowed to be free? How many times can a man turn his head and pretend that he just doesn't see? So many of the songs later reflected that same feeling of, you know, this America needs to wake up and look at its history and bring in Black and white and everybody together to demand civil rights and justice.
I think another interesting aspect, too, is to look at the fact that they were, I think, a lot more hands-on as far as lyrics back in the day, whereas like movements like Black Lives Matter today and Beyonce's Super Bowl performance and stuff like that, visibly, they definitely are embedded in the activist world and serious topics, but the lyrics really aren't there. There's not a lot of the content, a lot of discussion going on in music. You kind of have to really be visible and see these things happening, and that's really different than Bob Dylan and his really strong lyrics.
Reason for that, too, is this nationalizing of music, right, where you don't no longer play to these communities or regions. You're playing to a national audience, and so the way to monetize that is to try and anger or not confuse or potentially insult portions of the population. So you have this really mundane type music that doesn't really challenge or rock the establishment. It tries to cater to all different networks and demographics.
And speaking of corporate media, I mean, corporate music industry made up their minds long ago after Bob Dylan that they would not have another Bob Dylan, that what he was able to do with his songs, with his lyrics and mobilizing a whole generation, we can't have another guy like that, you know? I think they tuned in real quick to the power that one songwriter could have waking up the public. And, you know, Dylan was so original for that reason. He busted through. It'd be much harder for a young person today singing, you know, explicitly about Black Lives Matter or really about anything to have that cultural revolutionary weight.
And again, you can find that article at gcml.org. And that was Dr. Julie Frechette. That was one of her students at the University of Worcester. So always good to see the work that Julie Frechette is doing. Okay, Desiree, any more headlines for us?
Yes, U.S. implicated in targeting Yemeni civilians. This one brought to us by The Nation, student researcher Hannah Kim, and faculty Jeff Simmons at Syracuse University. Yemen has been ravaged by armed conflict, as we know, also by terrorist organizations such as Al-Qaeda. The U.S. let the internal socio-political state of Yemen fall to the wayside, is what they argue. Obama administration began backing Yemen's Mansour administration and implementing strategic bombings. This one talks about the hospital bombing. I don't know if you guys saw when it was briefly covered on the news, but basically 9 individuals were killed, including an MSF volunteer. What they argue is that this is one of the locations that they were well aware of and well aware that it was a hospital and that these were recovering victims. So a lot of people are kind of on the fence as far as what is really going on, especially with the ties with Saudi and the U.S.
This story reminds me of one of the problems I constantly encounter with this increasing monetization of media that's gone on since the 80s. That you used to have reporters who were embedded in these regions, so we'd at least get reported back when our bombs land. But now it's really most of the especially the corporate media coverage, but most media coverage in general, comes from our nation's borders talking about the bombs we're launching, not where they land or who they impact. So you know, luckily we have reporters like The Nation and elsewhere who are able to get back this information, but this is few and far between. That's what I think makes it such a crucial story.
The drone strikes and everything, U.S. involvement in Yemen has been such an underreported story, but you wonder what's going to happen now with the Trump administration, whether, you know, he threatens to pull out of a lot of the world, but at the same time, his main claim is that he's going to eradicate Islamic terror, and that would imply doing a lot more in the way of bombs and probably not caring as much as Obama did, even in terms of the casualties and the side, you know, the loss of life, civilian life.
I think that's really unfortunate. And also what they say is they claim that all military authorities were well informed of their location, like I said earlier, but failed to acknowledge it when planning the strike.
This is sort of one of the outcomes, too, of like the Obama years, right, is that the left really sort of fell asleep on the foreign policy and the drone in chief. Now, you know, very animated and rightfully so in this the face of a Trump regime. But during the Obama years, there was a lot of silence on these issues.
Yeah.
And, you know, now we're reawakening to them. But there was 8 years, I'd say, lost where there could have been some critical work done on what was done in our foreign policy.
He certainly set in motion the precedent that America would use that technological and military muscle without really consulting, yeah, to just go ahead and ignite this sort of drone war across the world.
Well, I'm Desiree McSwain, and that is the news that did not make the news.
All right, we will be back after this short musical break. Welcome back to the Project Censored radio show. I am Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host Desiree McSwain and our senior correspondent Michael Levitin. We want to shift gears now and talk about this issue of fake news. Fake news has been a phrase that has been increasingly used. And it's ironic in the sense that fake news does exist. We all know it exists, but the corporate media are the ones who are now determining what is fake news and what constitutes fake news. And we saw this when the Washington Post put out this list of websites that are supposedly fake news. I think Truthout was on there and others who do really good fact-based reporting. Sort of odd, just noteworthy, that the Washington Post, which is basically like this arm of the Democratic Party, is now determining what is fake news. But it's tied to these other stories about Russian hacking influencing the election, fake news hacking the election, basically everything influenced the election other than Hillary Clinton. It's really becoming, though, a normative phrase to use now. Barack Obama, shockingly, in his last press conference, actually talked about fake news.
And in his speech, final speech.
Yeah, it's now like this okay phrase to blame things on fake news, but not corporate media, right, which is what majority of people actually consume, which, if anything, is more responsible than these supposed websites that are informing people.
This whole fake news phenomenon, it's amazing how quickly the word, the term, sprang into use, what, just in the last months. And I heard from people in Europe, in fact, people in Greece who have been following in across Europe, obviously following the U.S. presidential election, they were writing, telling us over here, wow, this is really a Facebook election. This seems to be, and it was kind of before the fake news phenomenon even broke into sort of mainstream discussion. Mm-hmm. We weren't having that discussion in the first half of 2016, but I think they were aware of it across the world quicker than we were. And then all of a sudden, there it is. We got Trump in the White House, and okay, welcome to the fake news era.
I think maybe just with the election and us being in such a fishbowl and being in such a highlighted area, that once it was past Hillary's time and it was clear that she was obviously not going to be the next president, I think a lot of people were like, wow, I was really misled by this news, this quote unquote news. And that was kind of like once we were in the reality of the new presidential election, it became, you know, increasingly obvious to people that there was some fake news that I was consuming, whether it was a big box media or alternatives.
And I think that's the power of this propaganda, though, right? It's based in somewhat truth that people are informed by this fake news, this non-fact-based reporting. But why it's effective propaganda, it's kind of distracting from the issue, right?
Yeah.
That fake news didn't write the Democratic Party emails. Those emails are legit, right? These emails do show this collusion between heads of the party with Hillary Clinton and even people in media like Donna Brazile and Wasserman Schultz. And so we saw this collusion to try and fix the election, including trying to elevate the candidacy of Trump, who they ironically thought was an easier candidate to defeat compared to the other Republican contenders. But yeah, these stories about Russian hacking and fake news, I think, are carefully crafted propaganda that's being used to distract from the ways that the Democratic Party really tried to undermine the democratic process, mm-hmm. and ironically ended up being the big losers in their poor attempt.
Well, corporate media, of course, has been spinning half-truths and non-truths and giving us picking and choosing what they consider news for years, using really qualified and skilled reporters. Obviously, even at places like The Post and The New York Times, those are bona fide good journalists who do not believe they're giving us fake news. But clearly, those of us who, you know, were aware of climate change, say, 10 years before The New York Times started reporting it as a reality, as a real warning and a thing to pay attention to, that can be considered, in a sense, fake news. The things that they ignored telling us and continue, the
right.
corporate media continue to ignore telling us, maybe this fake news phenomenon will snap corporate media more into place because they will realize there's a real value and importance that they tell people what they need to know, truth-based, reality-based information.
And maybe it'll just come from the loss of viewers, because I think a lot of people are just losing faith in news in general, which could be a good or a bad thing. But if you don't seek out alternative models and alternative news, then you're only going to be consuming the fake or the biased, the extremely biased news. So,
yeah, well, I think, and, you know, that was like sort of the story that came out, right, was that this election, the media blew it. They had no idea that Trump was going to be successful. And they're now going to have this come to Jesus moment where they're all of a sudden going to reform themselves. But, I mean, the way they've been following around the Trump administration and continue to let him kind of dictate not only the amount of coverage but the type of coverage, normalizing Trump behavior, trying to convince the public, too, right? We hear these, like, media narratives about how he's our president now. You must respect the office, the presidency. He represents all Americans. Yeah, it's interesting that a guy with such, like, a racist, sexist, misogynist, making fun of disabled people past, is now being posited as the supposed unifying candidate by the corporate media. I think that's, like, the fake news, right? They're trying to normalize this guy as representing the American people, when, in fact, he's at every opportunity, he has shown that he has no respect for people of color, immigrants in this country, women in this country, and poor people, working class people.
Or truth in itself.
Or truth, too, right? The guy's consistently allowed to lie without really having his feet held to the fire.
But this is a moment. It is the come to Jesus moment for the media. I think people, it is the fourth estate. It is the one right now. We got the Supreme Court, we got Congress, and we got a presidency that does not speak for we the people, mm-hmm. as we consider ourselves in 21st century America. And yet there is a media that if they're going to have their moment, it's going to be now. And I think they got that sense even at their first press conference with Trump when he lashed out and accused CNN, you know, the media of being fake news. I mean, this will challenge media, and I think those of us in the alternative and more progressive space of media might reconsider or at least see the respect or some form of alliance with more traditional media for the mere sake that our whole democracy, in a sense, now rests on whether the media that has the real channels, the power to disseminate information, whether they step up and challenge Trump. So I think the media is going to have to coalesce.
I think it's a good time to note that at projectcensored.org, we have a lot of resources that educators can use and citizens can use to determine the validity of news and news sources. We've often promoted the 5 ways to flex your media muscles, which our associate director, Andy Lee Roth, has created. But I also want to point to a newer article we have up there now by Susan Merritt, who teaches at San Jose State University. And it's titled The Process of Establishing Integrity Checklist. And she provides a very accessible checklist for when you're reading an article to determine whether or not it is credible, whether or not it is valid, and determine its sources. She says you should look at the authority, that is, who is it that's producing this article that you're reading? What is the design and usability of the websites that you're reading as well? So look at architecture, navigability, design. And she also, this, and I think this is really the most important in my view, the message. What is the message the article is trying to send? I think a big mistake that we do in this country is we sort of teach people that the press is objective. Everything has a message. Everything has a bias. And you really need to turn your brain on to recognize what that bias is. To have some sort of slant to a certain ideology doesn't mean that the article is false. But it does mean that they're using their evidence to make a certain argument. You need to be able to recognize what they're doing with that evidence.
I think for general news analysis that works, I think it's really becoming hard because anyone can create a web page. Yeah. Anyone can call themselves a news site. And I'm a media person and a journalist, and yet I fell for a piece of fake news some days ago that concerned Russia Today having hijacked and taken over the C-SPAN line for 10 minutes, that C-SPAN went off air and Russia Today went on. And this was considered this kind of groundbreaking moment of Russia's true hacking our media system. But that was right on the homepage of Yahoo News, in fact.
Wow.
And that shot me right to the page, and I went to it, and it was published on a site called The Wrap. And all you have to do then is look and see what kinds of stories are on a site like that, but a lot of readers are not going to go and see the About page and see who are these people, what's their background, and look at other headlines. They will see that headline on Yahoo, which goes out to millions of viewers instantly, and read something that potentially is a catastrophic kind of headline if people respond to that without analyzing. And a lot of people simply won't know. I was duped myself.
I think I can speak to this as a millennial, too. A lot of how we get a lot of our news is even just screen captures and memes of these articles. So even just the title, the author, and then just a little snippet of what it may be. And for a lot of people, that's all they really need. And they just run from there and repost. So a lot of these individuals and younger people aren't even clicking on the article themselves and aren't even going to the sites. So they really can't discern for themselves, honestly.
It's truly turned news into commerce because just simply the more clicks, the wealthier they get, the more ads they sell.
Well, don't feel bad. A lot of people were bit by fake headlines like Barack Obama's post-racial America. It comes to mind. I am Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host Desiree McSwain. We're going to continue our discussion about the issues with news and fake news by talking to Chase Palmieri and Jared Fessler from Tribeworthy. Chase and Jared, I have a whole bio here on Tribeworthy, but I would rather hear from you. What can you tell our audience about Tribeworthy?
The point of Tribeworthy stems down to the fact that right now media organizations have lost the people's trust, and it's mainly because they're caring more about metrics such as views, shares, likes, and advertising revenue. And so the main goal of Tribeworthy is to establish a people's measurement of media success, similar to how Rotten Tomatoes review platform held movies accountable and Yelp can hold local businesses accountable.
Tell us a little bit about how Tribeworthy works and how people can access it.
Instead of Rotten Tomatoes and Yelp, where you just leave a subjective review about your experience, our review process is for online articles, and it's built through a critical media literacy framework. So the entire review process is set up so that you have to review an article objectively.
Okay, so I don't know. Jared, tell me. Say I'm an average news consumer. I wake up every morning, drink some coffee, pop open Facebook. How would I access Tribeworthy? How would it help me? How would I use it?
First, that sounds like my average morning right there. But if you're going to be the first time hopping on our website, of course, you're on Tribeworthy.com. And one of the very first things that you'll do is create an account with Tribeworthy. It opens you up to being able to see the ratings and actually rate the articles themselves. So say you've already done those steps. You're looking at the homepage of Tribeworthy, and you're confronted with basically two choices when looking at an article. Here, you're going to want to determine whether this article is trustworthy or not trustworthy. And the biggest feature for us is if you're choosing not trustworthy, you're going to be stepped through a process, a very media literacy-formed process to determine if this article is untrustworthy or not. Once you've gone through that process, then it updates and creates this rating score, which we're calling the Tribeworthy rating.
Okay, so would I, as a consumer, would I go to something like CNN.com and look at an article and be able to rate it, or do I look at the articles that are on Tribeworthy and rate those?
We're doing this in steps, really. So right now, you would be posting an article from CNN or New York Times or wherever you really choose and posting that to Tribeworthy, in which you'd be prompted to rate the article. But however, we're all very cognizant of how the user experience and want to interact with their news. So not only do we have a browser extension that would track you around to all the different websites and allow you to have our rating displayed as well as the ability to rate that article. And then further on down the road, we're going to be looking to incorporate an app to further include that user experience.
Chase and Jared, this is Desiree McSwain, and this is open to either of you guys. Have you experienced being duped by fake news yourself? And if so, did you kind of test and play around with some articles that you knew were fake news, in fact, through your own platform?
That's a very interesting question. I'd say that I've definitely read misleading information. I'm pretty good myself about using the critical media literacy framework in my own life, so it's hard to push outright fake news at me, but there's definitely times where you read an article from a different website or a different perspective, and then you're finally actually seeing the big picture. And because in this complicated world, most news isn't black and white, and it's important to see a story and a narrative from multiple sources.
Speaking of that, from this idea of multiple sources and multiple views, what measures is Triworthy taking, say, to make sure they get a diversity of stories?
We'll be pulling articles from various different platforms. So unlike Google and Facebook's solution that they're talking about censoring certain stories or blocking certain fake news stories, we're taking completely a opposite approach. We don't believe in any form of censorship. We believe that you should have every type of article on the Triworthy platform so that we can attach these critical reviews to them. So not only can anybody post articles, but we're also going after college campuses from across the United States. We're especially focusing on Midwestern towns to make sure that we're getting an objective viewpoint, not just from the coasts.
And if I may dive this down a little bit further down the rabbit hole, there's a book out there called Wisdom of Crowds by James Surowiec. It discusses three main points to creating this wise crowd, so to speak. It's making sure you have a diverse, independent, and decentralized group of users. So diverse people, like Chase is saying, from across the United States, having multiple colleges, towns, liberal versus conservative, et cetera, making sure that they're making decisions independent of each other, and then decentralized, meaning that they get their information from different sources, so not just within their own filter bubble.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Nolan Higdon, in studio with co-host Desiree McSwain and our senior correspondent, Michael Levitin. And we are talking to Chase Palmieri and Jared Fessler of Triworthy. And so remind us again, where can people go to access Triworthy?
You can go to triworthy.com. We will be having a mobile app launching in the near future. But as for the moment, visit triworthy.com, create your account, and you can start reviewing online articles right away.
That's wonderful. And so people can get feedback from other individuals on the potential problems with articles through triworthy.com, correct?
Yeah. So what's nice is next to the Triworthy rating, you can click the details button. And what that would do is it pops up a display where you can then see the identified root problems that the crowd identified for that particular article. So whether it's a particular type of logical fallacy or a particular type of bias, you can see what the kind of general consensus of the tribe is in relation to that particular article.
You guys are just starting out this ambitious and amazing goal. What can you tell us about your operation so far? What's the operation of Triworthy looking like?
It's looking always brighter and brighter, actually. So we're a team of six people right now, three web developers, one educational coordinator, and Jared is our marketing guy, and I'm leading the day-to-day operations. We have a small pool of funding, mostly family funding, but we're a very bootstrapped, low-cost operation at this point, and we don't see any reason why that has to change, especially now that the platform is built out.
Yeah, I would imagine, given all the discussions about the quote-unquote fake news right now, this is really a great time for you all to launch and something that's really needed. Are you getting a lot of positive responses in this current climate?
You know, speaking from a marketing perspective, I think this is the best and worst days for a lot of people leading up to the election and then leading into this fake news cycle. You know, it may be the worst thing for other people, but it happens to be the best thing for Triworthy, especially with this, you know, potential solution to solve it. So the feedback we've been getting from people is all positive thumbs up, waiting to see what they can do with our platform, and it just just makes my marketing job that much easier.
You spoke about having diversity within your stories and, you know, reaching both coasts, the Midwest and stuff like that. Is that also the case as far as you in your operations? Do you have a pretty diverse crew over at Tribeworthy?
Yes, we actually do. Just amongst the three original founders, which is me, Jared, and our software developer, Austin Walter, we come from all three different political ideologies. And that's actually why we turned to a critical media literacy framework, because we were all solving or trying to solve this untrustworthy online information problem in our own lives. And we wanted to come together to try to create a solution using technology and using a social network framework. But we couldn't really agree at first on how we were going to solve the problem without favoring a particular political ideology or mm-hmm. a particular founder's views. So that's when a critical media literacy framework became our North Star.
So what could you tell our listeners? What would you prefer our listeners to do to help Tribeworthy and help expand this access to fact-based news sourcing? What would you like our audience to do?
I would love it, and we would love it, if people would stop thinking about the media as a one-way conversation. Until recently, the media has been a one-way street where we're basically being talked at. Our goal is to introduce a new concept, which we're calling crowd-contested media. And the idea is that this should be a conversation. If the news outlets are no longer going to hold the powerful accountable, well, then the people need to hold the news outlets accountable. And that's what we hope to do with this platform.
Then you want people to go to tribeworthy.com immediately, correct?
Right away.
So it's tribeworthy.com. This is Chase Palmieri and Jared Fessler. Is there anything you two would like to say as well to our audience about this wonderful operation you all are launching?
Yeah, I would say that I don't think that we should expect Google and Facebook's platform changes to solve this problem. What that essentially means is either some form of censorship, or at the very least, we're outsourcing our critical thinking skills, which is especially dangerous in these times. And I don't think we can rely on fact-checking websites such as Snopes or PolitiFact as well, because they're not financially able to scale to meet the problem. So we really believe that the only sustainable solution to the fake news problem is for people to think critically and to work together in an effort to raise the media's standards to meet our own.
What you guys are proposing is just a very empowering concept for individuals, and you're doing it in a very digestible way at tribeworthy.com. So I would really encourage our listeners to check out tribeworthy.com and see the wonderful work you all are doing over there. I appreciate it, you guys coming on the show. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
We'll be back after the musical break. Welcome back to the Project Centered Show on Pacifica Radio. I am Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host Desiree McSwain. And we're going to continue this conversation talking to different movements from the millennial generation here. We're going to talk to Quentin Sankofa. Quentin is a collective member of Movement Generation Justice and Ecology Project. He is on a variety of Movement Generation's program teams, including the Black Land and Liberation Initiative and the Earth Skills Program. Quentin was born in a poor, racially segregated neighborhood on the east side of Cleveland, Ohio. Quentin, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So what can you tell our audience about Movement Generation Justice and Ecology Project?
concisely, as you mentioned, we are a collective of 8 individuals. Most of us come from various movement sectors. We kind of think of ourselves as some of the wounded warriors who have been kind of navigating the nonprofit industrial complex and our political work at the same time. But we've come to Movement Generation around this idea of ecological justice, given the moment of time that we're in with rising social inequality and also the collapse of our ecosystem. So we're kind of centered around those two lines of inquiry, understanding our ecosystems and our social movements and what social movements can learn from ecology.
About how old is the Movement Generation project?
I happen to be part of a second wave in the collective. Our core founders, might argue about the actual date because it depends on how they view it as when they came into it. But I think we're all in general agreement that it kind of has its origins in about 2007. So after Hurricane Katrina in 2005, a group of activists and organizers in the Bay Area began to meet and think strategically about climate change and the environment and saying that we needed to pay much more attention to it. And so some of those early conversations led to Jason Negron Gonzalez and Mateo Nube hosting a strategy conversation retreat for activists and organizers in the Bay Area. And they did that up at Occidental Arts and Ecology Center in 2007. And at that point, we weren't called Movement Generation, but that's kind of like what gave birth to the organization.
Quentin, this is Desiree McSwain. I know that you are originally from Cleveland, Ohio, but you guys are based in the Bay Area now. Can you talk about the differences and maybe some of the similarities that you see in movements between Bay Area and Cleveland as far as the work that you're doing and also a lot of what you're hearing from the community and what they're saying that they need?
Yeah, thanks. That's a really interesting question. You know, so much of organizing has to do with culture, right? And every place has its own unique culture, and there's, different cultures nested within bigger cultures or whatnot. So for me, as a person of African descent, I'm always in organizing spaces with other Black folks. And it's very interesting, it's just very interesting just because of dynamics, like growing up in the Midwest, where, for folks who might not go to the Midwest a lot, it's one of the most segregated areas of our country. People have this fantasy myth about the South and segregation and racism and oppression, which certainly, because a lot of Black folks live in the South, we, experience that racism at a different scale. But up north, we also have large numbers and are very segregated, right? So the segregation is interesting because, for example, in Cleveland, on paper, it looks pretty diverse, right? It's like 50% white, 50% Black, but literally 90% of all Black people live on one side of the town, and that's the town I grew up in, on the east side of Cleveland. So in terms of like organizing, multiracial organizing, coalition building is much more of a challenge, I think, in the Midwest than in a place like Oakland that has a real history of multiracial organizing, even though there's been great movements that have been, centered on various populations, obviously like the Black Panther Party. So for me, I think that's one of the big things, just like the demographics of the place changes the nature of the organizing and the culture. And there's a whole bunch of other things that go along with that. Like, I find, like, being in the South and being in the Midwest, but particularly the South, it's a lot more singing and organizing. It's a lot more cultural work that happens kind of, like, just as a matter of fact, right? And I think, like, what I've seen in the Bay Area is a little bit more intellectual, academic, at least in this moment, of styles of organizing. But I think young activists are very interested in bringing that kind of community-building spirit of song, dance, culture back to organizing in the Bay Area. Certainly, that I'm not trying to say that it's not present at all, but when I'm traveling through the South, like song and culture and dance and music is just so much embedded in the way people organize that they just do it kind of as a habit. And I think here in the Bay Area, we have to be mindful of it and be more intentional about it because I feel like sometimes we, don't center it in our organizing.
You talked about the multiracial aspect in organizing. Is your collective multiracial? Is it a Black movement?
Movement Generation for sure is a multiracial organization. and that's how we roll as a collective. However, when it comes to the Black Land and Liberation Initiative, we're actually in a deep partnership with an all-Black direct action training group called the Blackout Collective, because in no way, shape, or form does Movement Generation have any business solely running a Black Land and Liberation Initiative, right? So what we're struggling with and thinking through is, as a multiracial organization who has, you know, Black leadership represented by me and some of our allies on our planning committee, we know that we have to be in deep relationship with Black formations for this project. So MG, Movement Generation, is multiracial. Blackout Collective is all Black. And the Black Liberation and Land Initiative is a Black organizing space as well.
Quentin, tell our listeners, where can they go to find out more about Movement Generation and some of the other organizations you've been talking about?
Yeah, so Movement Generation does have a website, movementgeneration.org. Blackout Collective also has a website, blackout.org, I believe. It might be blackoutcollective.org. And then we have social media presence, both of those organizations. We're both on Facebook. You can find Movement Generation on Facebook. We have a page, and we're on Twitter. You can find us at MoveGen on Twitter. And, yeah, you can visit our website.
I am Nolan Higdon. You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio, and I am in studio with my co-host, Desiree McSwain, and we are talking to Quentin Sankofa of the Movement Generation Justice and Ecology Project. Quentin, can you tell our listeners, in the contemporary climate, why is an organization like Movement Generation Justice and Ecology so important?
Well, I'll say it from my perspective. You know, we are, again, a collective of 8 individuals, and we get to bring our whole selves to this organization, so we're not necessarily an issue-based group of people. And so I say that because each one of us has a different response to that question, right? So I just speak from my personal experience. I'm just going to take you back to 2005. I was in undergrad at Michigan State University studying urban and regional planning. I was taking a geography course. It was my senior year. And the first week of the course, it's August, late August, and the professor is like, hey, you know, we're going to talk about weather and weather patterns and things like this. And as we got into the course, he started talking about climate change, and he started talking about a storm that was brewing off the coast in the Gulf of Mexico. And he was saying that the waters in the Gulf of Mexico were unusually warm at that time because it had been a very hot year, and due to climate change, the water temperatures have been rising. And he said that that warm water could strengthen a storm into a hurricane, and if it made landfall around New Orleans, it could be devastating. And so I started to pay attention when he said that, because I've been in New Orleans as a radical Black activist. I know the importance of New Orleans to the history of my liberation and the liberation of our people. I have been there, loved the place, loved the culture, loved the people. So I began to kind of watch that storm develop into what we all know as Hurricane Katrina. And in that moment, it was kind of like the first time for me as an activist to say, wow, climate change is not just about melting ice caps and polar bears. Actually, this is about our people and our survival. I saw climate change and the disruption of our ecosystem meet the racism and the oppression, and I saw that collision, and I had not too many places to explore that with, right? Like, the Black organizations on campus I was working with, they were very much interested in justice and student organizing on campus around issues around race and sexism and things like that. And then the environmental groups that I was kind of like peeking into, who had been talking about climate change, were pretty much all white with no analysis around oppression. And so I really didn't have a space where I could have both conversations, right? From 2005 on to 2010, I yearned for that conversation, but never found myself in a space that would allow both. And then in 2010, while at the U.S. Social Forum in Detroit, I had the privilege to meet Carla Paredes from Movement Generation. She invited me to the Movement Generation Justice and Ecology Retreat, which happens up at Occidental Arts and Ecology Center. By this time, I had already moved to Oakland. And so, you know, I decided to take her up on her offer, because she told me, like, this is a place that people are going to talk about racism and climate change and ecology and nature and reclaiming our relationship to land and the ecosystems. And I was like, all about it. I was like, yeah, I've been wanting to have this conversation. So I say all of that to say that I think one of the most important reasons that our group exists is because we're able to wrap these conversations together and not look at them as separate, but to really have a holistic view around ecosystems and people and our relationship and social movement.
What's your experience been thus far with Movement Generation? Have you had a, say, easier time now having these discussions, pointing out the intersection of racial justice and environmental justice, or has it been difficult? How would you describe it?
I think part of what I appreciate about Movement Generation is we've been able to have a sharp analysis around these things that speaks to our people, that speaks to mass movement. And I would like to say that I believe we've been a part of a shift in consciousness around this issue. So, for example, in 2010, I wasn't having many conversations about climate justice or eco-justice, or not, I wasn't even hearing those phrases. But I believe that because of groups like Movement Generation, like the Climate Justice Alliance, and all of our allies in those movements, and of course the movements in the Global South as well, rural movements like the Landless Peasants Movement in Brazil or like the MST, I think we've been able to highlight these issues in a way that allows people to be more receptive to hear them. And then, of course, just to be real, there's been a ton of things that have happened that are big ecological catastrophes since Hurricane Katrina. People who experienced Sandy on the East Coast, understanding that phenomenon has also propelled people to really think about climate justice, I think. So I feel like because of those events that I've been able to have different conversations with people.
Quentin, can you speak to the relationship that MG has to low-income communities, primarily communities of color, black and brown youth, and how they relate to their food injustices and food deserts that they have around? Because I know that you talk a lot about black land, talking restoration of land, labor, and culture. How do you guys relate, or how do you see that issue?
It's multifaceted for sure. I think what's important for us is that our analysis calls for us to lead with vision, right? And be visionary and oppositional in our fight. And I think young people are really attracted to visionary thinking and visionary organizing. And in fact, I think they help create it. So for us, there's since work with young people and having intergenerational spaces is a very important thing for us. So we create a lot of different events and programs and spaces where folks are in dialogue with community. And we know that every aspect of our community, from young to old, has wisdom and knowledge to share, because we're all experiencing this thing called life together. And for us, it's all about the production of life, which is the basis of our economy, right? Like, how do we produce life? How do we produce home? How do we manage home? So for us, I think young people are at the center point of that conversation, because really it's their world to inherit. And it's our responsibility as adults to prepare a pathway for them to kind of like live out their full potential. So a lot of things that we do speak to young people. It's real hard to, you know, intellectualize everything to the point where it's at an academic level. I mean, you have to spend 4 or 5 years unpacking ideas and things like that, which is cool and necessary. But if you can't make those ideas translate to young people who are going to be the ones that take those ideas and actually add value to those ideas and actually make them real, then I think we're missing something.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Nolan Higdon, in studio with my co-host, Desiree McSwain. We'll be back after this musical break. Talking to Quentin Sankofa of Movement Generation Justice and Ecology Project. And Quentin, you were talking about the importance of young people, and we do a lot of work studying media, and the media narrative is often that young people sort of don't care or checked out, not paying attention to these critical issues. So what's been your experience? Are young people increasingly active in the various movements in which you're involved? Are they engaged? What would you say about young people you're currently working with?
I don't know where this line of thinking comes from. You know, that young people aren't engaged or young people aren't involved. I don't know, man. You know, people get older and get bitter. I don't know. I don't understand it. I've never seen a social movement that wasn't started and maintained and pushed by young people. So I don't understand that. But from what I see, young people are out here leading the way, and they're leading the way in a big way. I mean, the things that are coming out the Movement for Black Lives with a whole new cadre of young people coming into their own consciousness and pushing boundaries in beautiful ways, like making sure that the folks who are the most oppressed, the most exploited, are put at the center of our movement is such a revolutionary idea that didn't come from the generation before us in mass, right? Even though that generation was led by young people too. But I think all of these social movements are always going to be led by young people, point blank, period. That's just, yeah, to me, that's just like how life works. You know, like young people come up into systems and structures, they challenge and refine those systems and structures, and the cycle continues. So I wish we could put to bed this idea that young people aren't interested, motivated, or active.
Yeah, definitely agree with you on that. So can you tell our listeners, what are some of the specific projects you're involved in right now, and any details about those projects as well?
Well, we're involved in a number of projects. We were talking a little bit about the Black Land and Liberation Initiative earlier, and that's a phenomenal project that we are developing with the Blackout Collective that a lot of people have found great interest in. That program is really about training up activists, Black activists across the country, primarily around nonviolent direct action skills, you know, strategies and tactics, and also an understanding of land-based skills, helping folks understand the role of ecology and how to create certain things, composting toilets, gray water systems, rainwater catchment systems, things like that. And then also having a deep kind of like strategy piece around situating ourselves in this movement right now as Black activists, you know, seeing ourselves as a continuation of a movement that started long before us, and kind of situating that in this new paradigm with the new tools that are available for organizing and strategy and thinking and doing. So that's one edge of our work. We have other edges of our work as well. Brooke Anderson of Movement Generation, along with her organizing committee, run a program that we have there called Climate Workers, which is an effort to kind of push labor past the whole dynamic around jobs versus the environment and take them into a radical position around what we might say jobs for the environment, right? And so that's a very interesting piece that she's spearheading. We also do some cultural work, and we have an analysis that says, and it's not ours, you know, but it's like a movement thing, right? Like that we have to broadcast a transformative narrative, right? Like we have to tell our own stories, and we have to be visionary enough to put our people in positions where they see themselves in the new economy. They see themselves in a new paradigm. And so we have some cultural productions that we do. One of which is in production right now is a web series called The North Pole, which is just a really nice 7-part web series, comedic drama that Josh Healy at Movement Generation has written and developed with the outstanding creative team. And the idea of that show is it follows 3 North Oakland residents. For folks that don't know, old school North Oakland residents called North Oakland the North Pole, and youngsters coming up would call themselves polar bears. This is way before the climate change conversation. And so we're using that metaphor to explore gentrification and climate change. And so that's a really interesting series that's going to be released this spring as well. So we're just pushing the edge. You know, as a nonprofit, people don't think you're supposed to do those types of things, right? Like, who knows of a climate justice organization that's producing their own media like that, also engaged in labor organizing and also engaged in radical Black organizing. Like, we're trying to wrap this movement around ourselves.
You spoke a little bit about gentrification, and I was actually going to ask you about your perspective on that, coming again from Cleveland, Ohio, and coming into the Bay Area, which in a lot of people's opinion is the height of gentrification in Oakland, California specifically, and then West Oakland specifically, even deeper, but, you know, San Francisco, all these areas. But what is your perspective? Is it the same? Do you feel like this is just an issue in all, you know, brown and Black communities?
This is an issue wherever capitalism is. And capitalism exists, unfortunately, in every corner of this world at this moment. So, yeah, certain expressions of it in, you know, historically oppressed communities are going to look similar and different. But it's a problem everywhere because it's just a continuation of colonialism and imperialism and a myth of white supremacy. So as long as you have a economy that's structured on private land ownership, then we're going to have problems with gentrification. That's just the point blank piece of it. So, yeah, it looks a little different in Oakland just because it's at a scale and a pace that's different than in Cleveland. But, you know, we've been dealing with these issues around segregation and power and domination, you know, since the beginning of this country. So to me, it's just another version of it. It's kind of like the way as Black people, we were locked out of the suburbs when we were crammed into inner cities, And now we are being locked out of inner cities and crammed into third ring suburbs. So to me, it's just a continuation of the age-old issue, and that issue, to me, never gets addressed and never will get addressed until we deal with the private property question. Because, like, as a city, for example, right, like a city like Oakland is a municipality dependent on a strong tax base. They have a contradiction. They are tasked with providing goods and services for their population that require resources, and a big part of that resource is property tax. So for them, seeing a rising tax base actually is a good thing for them. But the contradiction is you have a whole city of people who need housing and need affordable housing, which is not the most lucrative thing for developers. So we pay our tax dollars to city officials who then do sweetheart deals with developers to bring jobs and all these other things, which is false because what they're doing is extracting profit out of communities. They're not bringing jobs. They're using people to extract wealth out of communities. That's what really happens. So anyway, I think it's a fundamental problem around private property and land speculation. And until we address that, we'll have various forms of gentrification that take place or displacement in general.
So, Quentin, in our final question here, could you speak to some of our listeners who may want to get involved or replicate some of the work that you're already doing? Where can they go? What websites? Who can they contact? What would you recommend that they do?
I think they should continue to listen to shows like this and continue to challenge their own thinking. And I think getting out into your community and listening to folks who are historically oppressed and taking direction and guidance from them is great. And in terms of like just institutional support, if you happen to be in the Bay Area, don't take it for granted, because my travel across the country and our culture around organizing and progressive values is special. And of course, we have things to work out and we're not perfect or anything like that. But you have access to some of the most brilliant, organized groups in the country right here. Groups like Cause of Houston Just Cause. I spoke about Blackout Collective earlier. Groups like APEN, groups like Urban Tilt in Richmond, Acton Verba in East Oakland, Poder in San Francisco. There's just a wealth of organizations. And I would just say reach out to them. If you're on a national tip, you can go to the Climate Justice Alliance website. That is a organizing vehicle that Movement Generation helped co-create with other groups like Grassroots, like GGJ. Point is, you're in the Bay Area. You have lots of access to radical thinkers and doers. Get to know some of them.
Thank you very much for coming on the show. It was a pleasure speaking with you, and we hope to hear from you again soon.
Hey, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate the time.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain.
This is Desiree McSwain with Nolan Higdon, Mickey Huff, and Peter Phillips will be back next week. You've been listening to Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. Anthony Fess is our producer. Erica Bridgman is our engineer. The Project Censored show airs on close to 40 stations around the U.S., from Maui to New York. To learn more about our work, please visit our website, www.projectcensored.org. Please follow us and like us on Facebook at Project Censored. We'll see you next time.
Political ties, habitual eyes, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, far for little poison. The weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens. And the ties for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love, we flip the brothers in our